You're now listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, broadcasting from sunny Orange County, California. Filmmaker, journalist, and film historian, Paul Booth.
Aloha. Welcome to Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. I'm your host. Man, I'm as hyper as it gets. This is the third show I've gotten to do in 3 days. Of course, they're going to be released at different times, but I'm literally twitching with excitement. Sunday, we did a review of Say Anything with our new co-host, Mrs. Kai Lovell. I, of course, call her Kai. You can go on our website, Facebook page, and check out our review of Bombshell and Monster. It is up and live, and it is official that Kai is the co-host of reviews and some interviews. But we're real talk with today's filmmakers. We're going to be joined by cinematographer Robert Yeoman. You'll know him from Wes Anderson's films, Paul of Them, Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic of Steve Zissou. I'll list a few more films before I bring him in. Whip It, Gus Van Sant's Drugstore Cowboy. Yes, the Gus Van Sant that made Good Will Hunting and Finding Forrester. He's got a slew of wonderful films that didn't have to meet audiences' expectations. Also, Love and Mercy, a great biopic of Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. And lastly, one of my favorites, Drew Barrymore's Whip It. So I see we have our callers. Are you with us? Welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm fantastic. This is my probably how you guys feel shooting the scene. So I'm like in the zone and as happy as it gets.
Okay, cool.
Yes, excellent, excellent. So we can dive right in. And as I had mentioned, this will kind of go all over the place, but there is a method to my madness. Such a wonderful gambit of stuff here from your work. It was so wonderful to go back and visit. Oh, you're very welcome. It was so great to go back and visit some that I knew really well and then kind of go back and just kind of be picking apart, what you do. I wanted to start out with Drew Barrymore's Whip It. I've always been very interested in Drew because, as you know, but a lot of people don't know, she's a hell of a film historian. And they just relate her as producing the Charlie's Angels movies. And then no matter how old we get, we're going to think of Gertie. So what I wanted to jump into was whatever you're open to explaining about how did that process come about of you and Drew, Mrs. Barrymore, Drew, getting together to do this film.
Sure. Basically, we connected through producer Barry Mendel, who I had done Rushmore with, Royal Tenenbaums with Wes Anderson. And he was producing the movie for Drew. And so they were talking about potential cinematographers and you know, my name was thrown in the hat, and I had an interview with her, which went very well. You know, we kind of hit it off right away. And that kind of got the ball rolling. And, you know, they eventually hired me, and we started. And, you know, it was a lot of fun working with Drew. She didn't know a lot technically about things, but she knew what she liked and what she didn't like. So it was very much a process. Like, for instance, during the prep, we were shooting Panavision at the time. And I took her over to Panavision and we shot tests with anamorphic lenses and spherical lenses. And, you know, we would look at the tests and she wouldn't know which was which, but she kind of said, oh, I like that one much better than that one. And she was kind of going with the anamorphic. So, you know, we said, well, that seems to be the direction of the look of the film that you like. And so it was constantly for me a process of kind of explaining things to her and showing her options. And then she could say what she liked. And you know, she's very astute and very smart, but she just didn't have the technical background on things. So that was kind of often the process throughout the movie, you know, is, you know, just kind of showing her options and discussing what, how it would eventually look. Cause we shot film back then, how, you know, it wasn't like today in digital where you can see it immediately. So, you know, but it was a lot of fun. She's a warm, wonderful person, and it was a great group of people, and, you know, making the movie was a blast, actually.
Well, that's, I was going to say, that's what I love about the movie is that it's got that, I mean, of course, when someone makes a film, I mean, okay, not of course, sometimes that real personality obviously comes through, and you know, because you help translate the personality, but that is a film where I'm just like, that feels like when you see her in interviews, that feels like when she's on The Tonight Show, like it's spunky and it's funky and it's, and of course, Ellen Page, fresh off of Now the World Knows Her as Juno. So given that you were talking about some of this technical stuff, what just blew my mind and made me literally is the reason why I asked to have you on the show was all these integral shots of skates. And I mean, I know where stunt teams kind of come into play, but I mean, was there skates that would sometimes kick the camera and you'd have to redo it? I mean, these were like really tight shots. I mean, can you explain a little bit of that?
Yeah, sure. Well, they had, you know, just as a, to give you a little background, you know, the actors came in quite a bit earlier, and we had a bank track, which we had to bring in. I believe it came from California, and we were shooting in Detroit. We found this beautiful old warehouse in Detroit, and we put the bank track in there. And a lot of the actual people in the movie were roller derby girls. So they were incredibly fast skaters and physical. And because we wanted to use the actors, which we very rarely use doubles. If I can't remember using doubles at all, really. You know, they the girls had to learn how to skate, which... So every day they would have these very rigorous training sessions, you know, of skating and, you know, just getting in shape. And, you know, Ellen Page is Canadian. So even though ice skating and roller skating are two different things, she actually was an amazing skater, probably the best. But Drew and Kristen Wiig and Juliette Lewis, all the rest of them, they all caught on pretty well and they were good. I mean, you know, they you know, could hold their own and, you know, we had to, try to make it look as real as possible. So, we often would put a camera, like, you know, you're asking, we would just put a camera on the deck, out there on the rink and they would skate by and they were pretty good about not damaging anything. I mean, I don't recall anything ever really getting damaged, but, you know, occasionally we get something would get hit. And, you know, we would check it out and make sure it was okay. And, you know, we have crash cams and things like that, that they could skate very closely to. And there was a little piece of equipment called a Grip Tricks, which we brought from California, which is a electric cart, which we would mount a camera and a special rig on the back. We could operate it remotely. There was a guy driving the cart. But the beauty of the Grip Tricks was it wasn't like gas. So it wasn't a lot of fumes being in there, everybody's faces. So, and it moved pretty quickly and was pretty maneuverable. So we relied on that pretty heavily. And so the driver would drive and he had a little video monitor so he could see, you know, where, what was in the frame. And so we'd say, you know, keep it pretty tight or, you know, we went a little looser here. And then with the remote head, we could actually operate the camera and pan and tilt it. So we relied on that pretty heavily to get a lot of the shots.
Wow, that's amazing. And that they learned to skate because it's so, I mean, obviously stunt doubles were smashing their face. I mean, what I loved about it, you know, was that Drew got her ass kicked the most. And I was just like, okay, that's a cool director. Like, you're not just going to, I mean, I know she didn't really get her ass kicked, but. Yeah, you know, but it's like, I just thought that's really putting it into your project. And again, I'm not saying you said it and I'm not saying it in any way about the technical side of her, but that's just an interesting point that I just want to say. There's not really an answer to it of to kind of have grown up with your honorary godfather being Steven Spielberg. It's just really interesting that she's not technical. You know, like that's kind of like my dad's an astronaut and I failed science. But anyways, and I mean that in the nice way. I love Drew. You know, I have since E.T., like anybody. Well, thank you for that because...
I was just going to say, you know, and again, she had a definite viewpoint, and she definitely knew what she liked and what she didn't like. And so it was just she didn't know how to achieve that, you know, and like whether it's a 25 millimeter lens or a 75 millimeter lens or, you know, certain things that we would do. And so, you know, there was a lot of that type of thing that went on with me and her where I would kind of show her, this is the feeling of this, this is the feeling of that. And she's, oh, I like that one much better, you know. So that was more of our process. And being an actress, she, you know, obviously, you know, understood acting and she spent a lot of time and bonding. I mean, the girls all really got along well. It was a relatively early movie for, you know, women empowerment and showing women in a light other than how they have been traditionally shown, you know, they're out beating each other up and certainly all the actors took their lumps on the movie because you couldn't help but getting knocked down occasionally and you know, there was a fair amount of black and blue marks all over the body, so it wasn't an easy movie on them physically, I mean, but no one can ever complain. And I think they were all on board and everybody loved Drew, you know, she's such a strong personality and, I it was a real kind of feel good kind of, atmosphere on the set at all times, despite all the physical, bumping and stuff that would happen throughout the day. You know, no, I never saw people lose their temper, you know.
Hey, well, that works, right? I mean, the last thing I want to say is that our co-host was a roller derby girl for years. So
okay.
She was like losing her mind when I said that you were going to be on today. She was like, what? Rip it. That's my favorite movie. And I was just like, don't worry. I'll get some questions in for you. It's all good. I'm interested in how the process of filmmaking evolves with you kind of do Bottle Rocket now. Of course, it's known. People go back to it. They find it. Let's just say it was obscure, independent. Rushmore hit that kind of cult following. I was in film school 20 years ago, right at that peak of where like everything was Spike Jonze, Wes Anderson, David Fincher, Paul Thomas Anderson. Nobody in my class wanted to know who John Ford was or Howard Hawks or, you know, Charlie Chaplin or David Lean. It was like these new guys invented cinema, right? There wasn't even 70s films. I'd say Peter Bogdanovich and some fellow classmates would be like, who? So anyways, before I go off on that tangent. So I'm interested in how the process, aside from technical, evolves when you say, okay, so Bottle Rocket is, let's just call it obscure for this question. Rushmore has this cult following and then Royal Tenenbaums is like, boom. I know people who love it that won't even finish Rushmore that might not like, Life Aquatic or Darjeeling, but they are just obsessed with Royal Tenenbaums. So is there anything you could say kind of about what it's like to evolve with a filmmaker through like those three different levels of how the work comes off or is accepted?
Sure. Well, when we did Bottle Rocket, you know, Wes was I think he was like 25 years old. He was a young kid. And, you know, he was obviously super talented and very bright, but he had never made a movie before. So, you know, a lot of that was for him kind of getting his feet wet and, you know, finding, you know, his voice, I think, you know, and it was a very personal story that he and Owen had put together. And, you know, it's, you know, as a kind of a funny little story, you know, we first started the movie, Wes really wanted to shoot Anamorphic and, on the 2.40 And so the studio, the people who are giving us the money were like, well, you know, that's more complicated and we want to see some tests. So we shot some tests before the production, and we shot Anamorphic, and we made these very kind of artsy frames, and I lit them very carefully. And then we would shoot the same test in spherical lenses, and we purposely made the frames a little awkward, and, you know, I would make the lighting a little less interesting. And we sent them to the studio, and they said, well, you know, we can't tell the difference, so you have to shoot spherical. So we were a little disappointed by that. I know Wes was. And so then we started shooting the film, and we just put up a 27mm lens the first day, and we just started shooting everything off the 27. And we just felt it was right for the film. And, you know, typically in many movies, you would shoot a wide shot on a wide lens, and then you'd put a long lens on and shoot a close-up or whatever. And we would shoot the close-ups with the 27 as well. And so we just started off on that, you know, maybe that became kind of our philosophy, use everything was on 27. And so about a few days, a week into it, the studio was like, well, wait a minute, we're looking at your camera reports, everything's on a 27mm lens, you can't do that. And so we said, okay, what do you mean? And the production manager came to me and said, you're not allowed to do that, you have to use other lenses. So we started putting on our camera reports, you know, 50mm lens, 75mm lens, and sending those in. And there's still all the 27. And then about a few days later, the production manager came up to me and was like, oh, I see you're starting to use other lenses now. And I said, yeah, we're starting to use other lenses. And he said, good, now everybody's happy. And it was still all the same lens, which kind of shows you what the people are in charge. But, you know, I think that Wes, and so when in Bottle Rocket, when it first came out, was not, you know, heavily well received, as you said. It was a film that people kind of discovered later, and you know, it's a great little film, but when it came out, it was not particularly, you know, had a huge audience. And oddly enough, Martin Scorsese saw it and really liked it. And he kind of championed the film a little bit and told people, whoa, you should check this film out. This guy's really talented. Wow. And that kind of gave it a boost. And so when Rushmore came along, you know, Wes had a little bit of clout by then. And so he was able to shoot Anamorphic, which, you know, was a game changer for us in a lot of ways. And, you know, he had certainly learned a great deal in his first experience on Bottle Rocket. And, he was able to get Bill Murray, which was a big coup for him casting wise. Because, you know, all of a sudden we had a real movie star in our film. So, you know, I think he was a much more, I'm trying to struggle with the word, you know, he had a much, his vision had, you know, kind of, became more elaborate, and he had a much stronger, mark on the film, and so it really connected with a lot of audiences. And you know, he took a chance on Jason Schwartzman, who had never been in a movie before, and it had a lot of Luke Wilson and a lot of the same characters that we had before. But Jason really came in and you know, hit a home run on that one. And I remember thinking, you know, while we were shooting it, you know, if people don't like Jason Schwartzman, we're dead here, because his character isn't exactly the most sympathetic character in cinema history, you know, and he's kind of a jerk at times, you know, but after we'd been shooting a while, I really warmed up to Jason's character, and I thought, we're going to be fine here. You know, he's doing an amazing job. And of course, Bill is always fantastic. And so Rushmore came out and it was a huge hit, and you know, a lot of people in the industry saw it and loved it, and then they went back and looked at Bottle Rocket, and I think that allowed Wes to then move on to Royal Tenenbaums, which was even a much bigger movie in a lot of ways. And we were shooting in New York City, and we had Gene Hackman and Gwyneth Paltrow and Ben Stiller and Danny Glover and all these amazing actors. And you know, all of a sudden we're in a whole different world here as far as the cast and the scale of the movie, you know, and living, working in New York City is a whole different style than working in Houston or Dallas. You know, it's a different, you know, a different place. So I think that's where Wes really stepped up, and you know, it's in some ways, you know, a lot of people consider it a masterpiece, and you know, I certainly do. It's amazing. I mean, I love all his films, but that one, I think, really, you know, put him on the map in a big way.
Oh no, it. Oh yeah, I'm not sure if I told you in emails or calls, but I don't say any compliments or things that I don't mean. So I always want to make that clear with a guest. But yeah, it definitely is a masterpiece. I remember when I saw it, I was like cutting out of college to watch films to prepare for film school. Why get educated and watch films? And I remember just discovering it and being like, who the heck is this? Knowing to not mix it up with P.T. Anderson. And respectfully, I'm not the biggest fan of Ben Stiller. So the fact that it was making me like Ben Stiller was like, okay, there's something really magical going on. Now, as we kind of can segue into some Royal Tenenbaums and Life Aquatic, what something you said brought up a question that I hadn't, that I didn't think of, was how does it, I mean, I know as humans, it just becomes normal, but is there any kind of the way, like I sometimes hear artists say like, okay, I've played with Miles Davis for 20 years, but it's still like Miles Davis came on stage. So it's like, you get Bill Murray when it's like, we didn't know we'd get Bill Murray, but then, I mean, it's down to where he'll just play a guy running towards a train in Darjeeling Limited. So it's like, is there still that little buzz of like, cool, Bill's here? Like, and I don't mean personally, I just mean as artists. Like, is that something that still comes up no matter how many films you do?
Oh, of course. Yeah. And you know, what we've been doing the last several films is Wes will say we're shooting in France or India or wherever, you know, and we didn't do this in New York City, but after that, we've pretty much done it. You know, he gets a small boutique hotel and we just kind of buy it out for the time that we're there. And all the actors live there. And Wes lives there, the producers, I live there, a few other people. And so we own the hotel. There's no one else there but us. And he gets a chef who comes in and he makes dinner every night. And so basically every night we're all at a table together. And I'm sitting there with, you know, Bill Murray and, you know, Edward Norton and, you know, whoever. I mean, just you look across the table and it's all of these giant movie stars, you know, what's interesting is it's a place where no one has egos and, you know, everyone's just a normal person there having dinner. And, everyone's super nice. And, you know, we talk about all kinds of things. You can sports or movies or art or, you know, and, it's really, that is one of the most amazing experiences, you know, just, having all these people in one room together and everyone's just kind of, like, it's like you're having dinner with a bunch of your friends, you know, and it's rare in today's world that you can create that type of situation. And, so I've known Bill, you know, Bill and I are actually from the same hometown in a suburb of Chicago and roughly the same age. And so when I first met Bill on Rushmore, we started talking and he said, where are you from? And I told him, he looked at me like, you got to be fucking kidding me, you know? And then we kind of traded stories. I grew up going to public school. He went to Catholic school, but we knew all the same people. And turns out he lived next door to one of my close friends. And so we kind of bonded over that. And we're both Chicago Cubs fans. So we had that going for each other. But Bill is always, he's a little bit larger than life. He's always on, and he's always funny. There's always something going on when Bill's there. But that's part of who he is, other actors tend to be a little more less on, they're a little more quiet or whatever, but somehow everyone gets along and there's very little tension on the set with Wes. I mean, people are there because they want to be there. And he even has this kind of a standing offer for the actors, even if like a lot of movies I'm on, the actors will say they're shooting on Monday, they show up on Saturday and as soon as they're done shooting, they're on a plane and they leave. But with Wes, a lot of the guys, actors can come in a week or two early. They're welcome to stay a week or two later, as long as they want. And a lot of them do, they come in early and they kind of acclimate themselves and get to know everybody. And they spend time with Wes discussing their character, getting their wardrobe, et cetera, et cetera. And then when they're finished, many of them just stay and hang out for a while because they're having so much fun. And I can say it's unique, a unique situation that I've never really encountered on any other movie before, So, I don't know if I answered your question, but
thank you for that personal story about Bill Murray. I mean, that's before this pre-pandemic thing. I have eight producers of this show, and all I was ever thinking about was what you just said. They're all over the country, and I just thought, if I could just have dinner with all these people, some who haven't met, that would just love each other. If I could just have dinner with all of us. And just so like when you were saying that, I was just like, wow, that is such a perfect thing to do. And of course, obviously, as you know, but that now clicks with me how the cast is so, aside from well cast, well directed, great script, how they're able to travel into these different, my opinion on his films is that it's realism kind of in a fantasy world and not the way fantasy is used, like Never Ending Story. So that kind of Royal Tenenbaums to me was just the whole thing about he carried me to a hospital because I was stabbed and he was the guy that stabbed me. Like, I just think should be on the top five movie quotes of all time. but it just always gets me. I can count it down and I'm just like, that would be so funny if a hitman tried to kill you and took you to the ER. So with the Life Aquatic, I know the Criterion DVD went over it, but I was not able to find it now because why would we have DVDs in this world? But I would love to get your perspective on how that boat set and any specific challenges. I mean, other than that, making movies is a challenge, to where just dealing with that kind of multi layered and also leveled boat and moving in and out of there. Like how was that for you?
Yeah.
I've PA'd on sets and I've produced indie features. And so I know that even the smallest crew is tight in some of the places you shot.
Yeah. Well, basically there was the real boat, which was the Belafonte, which they, Wes and the producers and our production designer, Mark Freeberg, had just a heck of a time locating a boat that we could use, of that size and that would fit what Wes was looking for. And they did find one, but it needed a lot of work. And so we shot all the exteriors on the actual boat, which was, kind of moored at a place called Sabaudia, which is about an hour drive from Rome where we were stationed. So every morning we would get up at dawn and, drive out to get on the boat. We'd get on it first thing in the morning and go out. We had to go out away from the coast because the idea was they were out in the middle of nowhere and you didn't want a coast in the background, and we didn't want a bunch of other boats in the background either. So we would just, you know, motor out as far as we could, like an hour, and then we would shoot all day and then motor back after dark. And that was a process on that boat. It was a little challenging, you know. I remember there was one bathroom on the boat that always broke within an hour. So, you know, that created a certain amount of, I don't know how the women dealt with it, but I know how the men did, you know. And the other problem we had was because we would have to turn the engine of the boat off because it created too much sound. The sound man, who's a close friend of mine, is bitching and moaning about the sound. So, and Wes wanted the sound to be good, so we would have to turn the engines off of the boat when we were actually shooting. And so basically what that meant for me was the boat would start to drift. So we could start a scene in backlight, and then by the time we had got to the end of the scene, it had totally moved around and now is in front light. So that wasn't really working for me very well. So we had a Marine, a British Marine type C, you know, group of guys who came and would help us, you know, maneuver the boat and do things. So they had smaller boats at the front and the bow, and they attached lines to it, and they would try to hold the boat in position while we were shooting so the sun wouldn't change and we'd be always be shooting the same direction. Now, well, that it presents its own problems, and so it was always, you know, trying to keep the boat in the right position for the sun, for me, and not having the engine on. So it was difficult. And of course, you know, some days we'd go out and it'd be very sunny, and some days we'd go out and it would be totally foggy. And so it was a little bit of a mismatch lighting nightmare for me. And it was not easy. And because the boat had multiple levels and they had these very narrow steps to go up, down, you know, it was, you know, we'd have to haul all the gear up and down these narrow little steps. And it was a difficult working situation. It was always a challenge and, frustrating often. And, you know, it was hard to work on the boat. Every day, you know, we would, as we got on the boat, there was an Italian nurse who would give us these patches to put behind your ear for seasickness. And, you know, I'm not one who usually gets seasick, but I was the DP and the camera operator, and I knew that if I went down, the whole thing was screwed. So every day I'd get a little patch behind my ear so I wouldn't get seasick. And after this had gone on for a few weeks, I remember by the time I got back to my room in Rome at night, I would be, the whole world was spinning on me, you know, and I felt like I'd been drugged, you know, and so I said, it must be just from being on the boat all day. I don't know. And so I remember after doing this for a month or two, I went and the Italian nurse, I got in line to get my patch. She goes, "Oh, no. Oh, once a week." I said, "Once a week? I thought we were supposed to do this every day." "Oh, no. Once a week." So I had been taking this patch every day, and I was only supposed to do it once a week. So I was filled with all these seasickness drugs, and that was what was making me dizzy, you know. But, you know, and then anyway, so that was life on the boat. It was difficult. And hopefully, you know, I think it all paid off in the end. And Wes was certainly very eager to make things as real as possible for not only us behind the camera, but for the actors as well. And so, you know, it was a hard to shoot on the boat. Then the set, you know, which we built on a stage at Cinecittà, stage 5, which was the Fellini stage where he had filmed so many of his films. Mark Freeberg had designed the set, and it was the cutaway where you kind of see into the whole boat at once. And You know, I remember there had been, I don't even know who did this, but someone had done a calculation with a 30 millimeter anamorphic lens, how far it was away that you had to, the boat had to be for that distance to see the whole thing. And I don't even know who did this calculation. So they set it up, and, you know, I talked to Mark, our production designer, and I said, you know, if you can give me a little room off the wall, because we have to do all this lighting on the psych behind the wall and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so they built the boat, and when they had it kind of all framed up, it was still, you know, we're doing the finishing on the interiors and things. I went after work one day, and Mark and I went over, and we stood on the stage, and we put the 30 millimeter lens on a finder, and we couldn't get the whole boat in the shot. So we looked at each other like, oh my God, what do we do now? You know? So, I called Panavision and I said, do you have anything that's wider than this lens? And they said, oh, we got a 28 and, you know, somewhere else. And I said, oh, please send it to me tomorrow. So they sent it. And, in the meantime, Mark didn't know what to do. We were freaking out. I said, just push it up against the wall. It was bottom a few more, a few more feet, but they went up against the wall. I said, I'll figure out how to light the psych. Just, we need to get it further back, because we literally were standing in the doorway as far back as we could. I mean, the camera was outside, you know, looking through the doorway.
Oh, wow.
So, they got these trucks or whatever they did, and they pushed this giant structure back against the wall. And I mean, the Italians were pretty resourceful in how they do these things. And, you know, they somehow got this giant boat and pushed it back 10 feet to the wall or whatever it was. And, the 28 millimeter lens showed up. And so I called Mark from the set. I said, oh, the 28's here. Let's check it out after work. So we went and we stood in the doorway, literally the camera's outside, looking into the doorway. And I mean, if I had to move back one more inch, we couldn't have done it, but we were able to, get the whole boat in the shot. So, it was kind of a scary moment for me and Mark, but you know, it was a fun set, and, we used a lot of those rooms for all our interior work, and lighting it was a bit of a challenge, but we pulled it off, I think. And you know, there was a lot of lighting changes that happened within the shot. And we used a techno crane, which is, I think, maybe the one that, well, we used it once on Royal Tenenbaums as well, but you know, Wes typically doesn't like using, you know, remote heads and that type of thing. So, but just to make the moves and stuff, we put the Technicrane on a track, and we were able to move around very quickly and move in and out. And so that's how pretty much we shot it, you know. And I created just a big soft source behind camera, and that kind of filled it in. Then we had the practicals and hidden lights where we could. And, we shot all the interiors, not on the actual Belafonte, because it was too cramped and too difficult to work in. So the exteriors were on the actual boat out at sea, and the interiors were on the stage, basically, is how we did it.
Oh, wow. Thank you. That's such a great story. Cause I mean, obviously it was seamless, and the sky is going to be the sky. Because I was just exactly watching for what you do, and I know you don't control the sun. I was talking about that yesterday with our guest was Jim Deneau, and he was talking about the sun was up in this one shot of Boys Don't Cry, and I was just like, if you control the sun, let's turn it back a couple of years. So I was just like, I love hearing about that. And so that kind of brings me to something. It could be however you want to go with it, but I'm always interested, like when I was 12, the first director I ever read on a poster was Oliver Stone, because I saw JFK. And that's what made me want to make movies and get into films, until I saw Dog Day Afternoon. And that was like, I don't care what I'm doing, I'm going to do this. And whatever. If I live to be 100, I'm going to fall over doing something with movies. So I would then pay attention to Robert Richardson, and then I would be like, okay, this is cool that he does all these films with the same person. So then it's the same thing like Deakins and Coens, and now what Scorsese's building with Rodrigo Prieto. I mean, obviously, you know, when it's a great cast, great script, great story, but beyond that, I've never gotten the chance to meet one of you guys who has such a consistent body of work with the same director. So is there something you could share that kind of just like makes that to where you're just like, you know, you guys can just get through it, you not stand each other, but just like what makes a cinematographer be like, okay, I'm on this director's flight plan, you know, wherever it goes, you know?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that the very first time I met with Wes, we discussed different movies, and, you know, we talked about movies we liked and movies we didn't like, and, you know, we were really on the same page. We kind of hit it off, you know, creatively, and so I think that we... you know, we start with that we're not coming at it from opposite ends. Like we rarely, I would say, oh, why don't we do this? You know, I mean, we're kind of start with a similar kind of vision of the film, I guess. But of course, you know, he has his own specific ways of tailoring it to make it a Wes Anderson film. And only he can do that. You know, he controls everything so carefully. But I think that the value of the cinematographer director relationship is that not only hopefully you get along, which we do, but also, I can anticipate things that, you know, he will want. And many times, you know, I can kind of set things up before he gets to the set, and then he'll come in and tweak it, and he'll, you know, and he'll fine tune it and make it exactly what he wants, you know. And you know, so I think you can cut through a lot of the discussion. It's a more streamlined process when a cinematographer and a director have that type of relationship. And it's not just me, it's the costume designer, it's the production designer, you know, the editor, you know. And so Wes tends to hire a lot of the same people because it you cut through a lot of the process and you can cut right to the chase with it, you know. And I know he has a very specific way he likes to work, and because I've worked with him so much, I know, and I can, you know, oftentimes I remember on Grand Budapest Hotel, there was a lot of discussion in production meetings, which Wes doesn't attend, and they would say, oh, this and this and this, and I would say, listen, you guys, unless you do it this way, he's going to be really unhappy. So let's not do it the way you're saying you want to do it this way, but I'm telling you, that's not going to fly. You got to do it this way. Okay? So let's just, so, you know, I think I can represent him a little bit in these situations you know, it allows to take some of that burden of that off of him so he doesn't have to deal with a lot of that kind of thing. And you know, he's very specific when we work. We have worked out the shots all in prep. We all kind of know what, when we go to work, what we're going to be doing. It's not like he shows up with no plan and, you know, you make it up on the spot. It's all very carefully controlled, very carefully thought out beforehand. And so when the day comes to do the shooting, we all know pretty much what we're going to be doing. And I can go in and set it up. And then, like I said, he'll come in and fine tune it and, you know, put the finishing touches on. So it's a much more streamlined process, you know.
Oh, okay. Because what's always tripped me out, I don't usually tell this story, but I don't mind because you've been so open. When they shot The Descendants in Hawaii, I'm a huge Faden Papa Michael fan, and I, of course, I'm an Alexander Payne fan, but what so intrigued me was I know they do so many films together, and as you had mentioned, you kind of know and you have this shorthand. Well, there was this one day where, of course, I wasn't by their side all day, but due to the nature of the shooting, we were in the same area for the same, and I don't even recall seeing them talk twice. And I'm not saying they weren't planned or prepped, but it was just to my brain, the first time seeing it and experiencing that relationship, I was just like, you know, our editor of this show, he sometimes like edits in a way where I'm just like, oh, I thought I screwed that up. And you, how'd you figure out that's what I was thinking? Well, of course, we've known each other 20 years. So he, you know, he knows me, knows my, like you're saying. But I just remember that being so weird of like, going into the movie and just being like, gosh, that was an amazing shot. I was 10 feet from the camera and you two didn't really talk that day. And I, like you're saying, I know it's prep, so it sounds naive on my part, but that's what has always interested me about the groove that you guys find. Like you're saying, you can be at a meeting for Budapest, which can lead me into the Grand Budapest Hotel, which... Before we jump into some of the specifics, sure, you heard this question a million times, especially during season, but we've never actually asked it on our show. Are you up at 4 a.m. watching the TV, or are you waiting? Are you just not even think about a nomination? How does that work when you got your nomination?
Oh, for the nomination? No, I was actually shooting a commercial. So I did have to get up early that day to, go to work. And we were shooting in Los Angeles. And, okay, yeah, he can come down. Sorry, my son's got
no worries.
Soccer thing. I got to move rooms here. I'm going to move over. So I got up early that day to go to work, and there was a message on my phone machine. I made me like my phone was a machine. And it was from some people I knew in New York, and they were calling to congratulate me. So I listened to the message because, the first thing I do is check my messages in case something's going on with the production. And and that's where I found out, you kind of always hope that something like that will happen. But having never been nominated before, you don't count on it because there's a million other factors and there's so many other great films. And, I knew, Chivo and Roger Deakins were also had movies. I mean, those are two spots right there. So it's always a bit of surprise. And then the phone call started coming in, and that morning I was on the set and my phone was ringing, every 5 minutes. So, it was certainly a pleasant surprise. But yeah, I guess no, I tend to not think about that kind of stuff. So rather than get my hopes up and think, oh, maybe I'll get nominated, which, there's a little bit of that, but, it's like, you don't want to set yourself up for a big disappointment. And as I said, there's so many factors that go into those decisions, and the competition is so tough. There's so many great movies, and, many times during the year, I'll see a movie that I think is incredibly well shot that doesn't even get any attention. So, you have to kind of not get your hopes up, I guess. So that's kind of how I approached it. So, but yeah, it was a wonderful thing. And the whole experience of going to all the, the events and all that, it was a BAFTA as well. And so I got to go to England and you know, go to the BAFTA awards. But, you know, again, I had Roger Deakins and Chivo, and Chivo won most of the awards, you know, for Birdman that year anyway. So it was kind of tough.
Oh, right. Ran three Oscars in a row. Yeah. All right. So, yeah. So Grand Budapest Hotel, thank you for explaining that, what it feels like to be nominated. We appreciate that. So as I went through that film again, gosh, this is such a, so many layers, like obviously, not obviously, a lot of photographers all mention, you know, painting, a love for this. That was one of the films where I've watched that felt the most like paintings. And unfortunately, I'm not the kind of guy who can go back and discuss like 1600s paintings. But was there any effects, green screen, something that kind of made that be like a, I mean, that was just so much like just watching a documentary about paintings. I mean, what were some of the tricks there?
Well, you know, from the beginning of shooting with Wes, he likes to do things in camera as much as possible. You know, he assembled, particularly on that film and The French Dispatch, you know, he assembles a library of photos, DVDs, articles, books. And anybody, the actors, the crew, was able to access that library. And so that, but he was very much influenced originally by, God, I forget what you call those things, but they're kind of hand-colored around the turn of the century photos that people would take and hand-color them, you know. And So they have kind of a faded, kind of unreal look about them. So they're in color, but they're originally in black and white. And again, I can't remember what you call them. But he was very eager at first to kind of achieve that. And there was a certain amount of testing we did. And there was a colorist at that time in London who was, you know, playing around with it, you know, and he never really kind of got what Wes was going for. And, you know, so we kind of abandoned that idea, but we looked at a lot of older movies. It was also our first movie in the 1:33, it was 1:37 actually, aspect ratio. And so, you know, we kind of, you know, I watched a lot of like 30s and 40s European movies and American movies too. Grand Hotel was one of them. And we kind of looked at those as our inspiration. And, you know, I think it's just our locations and the production design and the costume design all kind of gave it that painterly feel. And there was a very, as in all of Wes's films, there's a very specific, palette that he chooses. And we're very careful to control that. And so like, the walls of the hotel, which actually what it was in reality was Wes had gone through much through Eastern Europe. And I went with him one time and Adam, and we went to Prague and a lot of these places where, like in Prague, they had, the communists had come over and they had painted over all the old buildings because they wanted everything to be very, the same and kind of this austere kind of color. But then as you peeled away, you know, as they were, you know, going back and peeling away all this old stuff to, restore it to its original look, it was really interesting to see. And you know, we kind of referenced that in the film with the lobby of the hotel. There's the you know, it goes through a certain time period. And it starts out in a very austere kind of thing, and you know, and then we peel it back and make it more lively with the colors, and like that kind of pinkish color with the walls were. We shot a lot of tests, and Adam, our production designer, would give us, you know, a space of a small wall, and he would paint it one shade and then another of the same kind of color that we would have different tones and a little bit different, you know, brightness levels on. And then we would shoot it with film and just to see how it came across on film. And anyway, Wes had been looking for a hotel that we could actually use, but that really didn't exist because no hotel's going to let us paint and change everything. And, so what happened was he was kind of cruising around Eastern Europe and someone said, hey, well, there's this town in Germany called Görlitz. And they have this old kind of department store that's not being used anymore. Would you want to look at it? And he said, okay, I'll go there. So he went there and this place was this giant, at one time, department store with this giant kind of atrium in the middle. And it was five stories and there was this giant skylight up top. And, and so it was kind of perfect because we could lease this place. I think we got a 6 month or a year lease on it. And it was, we were very self-contained. Like the top two floors were production offices, wardrobe, camera room, et cetera, et cetera. And then the bottom floors were all used as different sets for the hotel. And we could do whatever we want. We could paint the walls. We could, you know, do anything. So it was kind of the perfect setup. And so we were all very self-contained. And then the other locations we just all found around Görlitz, which was this old East German town that, you know, had all these amazing old buildings that, you know, some of them had kind of fallen into decay. So the art department would come in and they would do a little bit of renovation things for the shots that we do. And, but a lot of the bare bones were already there. You know, it was just these beautiful old buildings that just needed to be kind of propped up a little bit or to some degree a lot, but, you know, but they were great spaces for the art department to work in to transform them into, a really beautiful set. So a lot of it was just going into existing locations that had kind of been fallen into, they needed some work, but we used that, the basic bare bones of them to create the sets, which were, and we could paint them and do whatever we wanted to give that feeling. And so, it was a kind of perfect place to shoot. And most of our locations were within a 10-minute walk from our hotel. You know, it was amazing.
Like some off the record stories. Sorry.
Yeah, no, and we could just walk, like that whole scene when Saoirse Ronan and Tony meet on the little merry-go-round. I mean, that was like a 2-minute walk out the front door of our hotel. We found it and I said, well, why don't we just set it right here? This is perfect, you know? And so it was unique in that way. And, you know, many times on movies, you're having to drive, an hour or 2 hours here or there. I mean, the prison was in another town, so we had to go there and, for a couple of days, I think 3 or 4 days or whatever it was, you know, and so you had to actually move to that prison. But most of the stuff was right there in Görlitz. And it was just kind of this beautiful, quaint little town, the city that had so much to offer us. And as I said, with a little bit of work by the art department, we could transform them into our sets.
I love that. Well, because it's so interesting you said department store, because literally when I was watching it, I thought that reminds me of that famous Macy's in Chicago. Because I've been to Chicago a few times because I'm like a blues nut. Like I could just live on Catfish whiskey and blue. Well, I don't drink anymore, but you know, I could just be in a blues club every day till 4 a.m. and just let life pass me by and think I lived a good life. That's crazy that you said it was a department store. Chicago. And on a side note, it's just so awesome. I love that you guys beat the Indians. I cannot stand the Indians. And on that note. Let's see. I know. Okay, so just a really quick question I had about Love and Mercy.
Sure.
As we, what I was really intrigued by, how I'm sure you'll be okay with it. I think drugstore, I'm just going to take off because right now I have a relative going through an opioid problem. So I want to just keep this how it's been fun, and I don't want to slip into, but I recommend to everybody you see Drugstore Cowboy. I'm pretty sure it's Heather Graham's first movie.
Was it after Life is a Drive? I think so, but I don't quote me on that, but I think it was her second.
Okay.
But she was young. She was very young.
Yeah. So Heather Graham, because now I'm finally feeling aged enough. People, this is Mercedes. License to Drive, of course, we understand is the, you don't have to have a girl in a car to be cool. So myself in the show is not saying that 80s movies are some form of religion. They are what they were, to be PC about it. But this movie was just so cool because a lot of people my age think of her as Roller Girl. So this is just a great thing. And Matt Dillon's superb. These guys are heisting pharmacies. There's nothing funny about it, especially with the crisis that's going on in the world. But please check out Drugstore Cowboy, especially the cinematography. It's so gritty. And Gus Van Sant, I mean, I think we could do a whole other podcast about his work and him. But so with Love and Mercy, Brian Wilson's story, and your intercutting between two of my favorite actors, Paul Dano and John Cusack, and you're representing with your photography, obviously, the flashbacks. And they're not obvious flashbacks. You found that tone to where I didn't feel like it was like, okay, now we're to young Brian, or now we're to crazy John, or, you know, whatever. So what I was wondering was when you go into a biopic, that's something that's so relevant and known to the world, other than so many people didn't know he was had as many mental issues as he did. What was there like some music prep for that outside of just standard Beach Boys? Was that like you had to be in this musical world to shoot something like that? Or was it still just you're coming in and you're you? I mean, what was that like?
Well, the music prep, because I grew up during those times, my brother was a huge Beach Boys fan. So we, I listened to The Doors, and The Beatles, and Stones, Led Zeppelin, I mean, all that, you know, that was my time. So I was quite familiar with all that kind of music. And, but
I'm jealous.
But I hadn't, growing up, even I really didn't fully appreciate what a genius Brian Wilson was, you know, and of course, we did extensive research and looking at books and familiarizing ourselves with all his albums and, whatever video we could find, we would watch. And you kind of came to realize that this guy was really something special. And one thing that is a little bit unrelated to what you're asking, but I kind of fought for film because it was, a lot of films that when we made that were being shot digitally. And I said, this was an analog time. And I think it's important that we shoot this with film. And, luckily Bill Pohlad, the director, and I shot Tess. And I even went as far as to say, I think we should shoot the Paul Dano stuff on 16 millimeter and the John 35 millimeter. And we shot a lot of tests and Bill Pohlad, to his credit, he loved what I was doing. And I never would have been able to do that without his backing because of course the producers didn't want to do it. It was going to cost more money and blah, 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 blah. And I think the test that we shot and particularly the 16 millimeter. I mean, I said, you know, certainly digital is a great, and I'm not bad behind digital. I shoot a lot of things digitally. It's a wonderful medium, but I said it just doesn't have, it has a different feeling than this 16 handheld feeling that we can get. And I think that will really, you know, give people more the feeling of the time period. And you know, Bill even pushed us to take it further. All the stuff in the recording studio, we shot, you know, typically I like to shoot with one camera, but, you know, a lot of stuff in the recording studio, we would shoot with two cameras. I have a great operator, Casey Hodgkiss, that I use sometimes. I operated the other camera. And, you know, it was the only movie I've ever worked on where Bill would rehearse the actors, like in the recording studio I'm talking about, those seats. And Casey and I were not allowed to see the rehearsals. Typically, I'm there watching everything. And because he wanted it to be shot documentary style and that we wouldn't know what was going to happen. And it would be more just us reacting to situations. And so that meant the lighting had to be kind of more general lighting. You know, we used a lot of top light that I wouldn't see the lights. And he also encouraged us to make the frames messy, you know, which is totally against our instincts. You know, you're always trying to make really nice, beautiful frames. And he was like pushing us to really mess it up a little bit. And at first, I can't speak for Casey, but, you know, for me, it's like, oh, God, no, I don't want to do this. But you know, as I kind of got more and more on board. So if I found that the frame was too perfect, I would kind of mess it up a little bit, you know, and I think that by doing that, it gave it a more of a sense of reality. Whereas with John Cusack's stuff, it was more 35 millimeter cameras on a tripod, you know, a lot more, you know, steady type look, more conventional, I won't say conventional, that's the wrong word, but, you know, just a more, you know, it's a different feeling so that we could distinguish between the time periods oftentimes by those two separate approaches to how we shot them. And I think it was quite effective, and a lot of people who saw the film really enjoyed the sequences in the studio quite a bit. Said, oh, that really felt like we were there. So I think that whole approach worked for us. And just as an aside, we shot in the actual studios that Brian had recorded in, and they were all on, you know, Sunset Gower up there around in Hollywood. They were pretty much the same. The only difference was the mix board was quite a different today than it was back then. And Keith Cunningham, our production designer, went in and they got the old mix boards and they designed a thing that they could put on over the new ones. So they, you know, we wouldn't see the new ones. And so that the mix boards would be accurate to the period. And that was mainly, well, one of the main things that the art department did to kind of make it seem like it was old, but a lot of the studios were pretty much the same as they had been back then. So, and, you know, one of the, just another quick little story, one of the great moments and one of the joys of working in the film industry was Brian came to the set one day and, cause he was a producer on the film, and, he walked into the recording studio and I was standing right there, and he kind of, as he walked in, he looked around and he said, yeah, I remember this place, you know, I'll never forget moment, you know, and just seeing Brian and just him kind of walking around, looking at everything. And the whole cast was there and he was talking to the actors who were all members, you know, Paul Dano and all the other actors. And it was just kind of a special moment for me, you know, just seeing Brian there and, you know, it just seeing him kind of relive some of his memories.
Oh, that's great. It's too bad Jim Morrison couldn't have walked in if you were shooting the Doors. No, that's so awesome. I'm a little bit reversed because I'm 41, but I grew up with, most of my, a couple of my really good friends and mentors are in their 70s. So I'm not really into much music that's after like 95 or 2000. So all those things you just listed is like my record collection. So when I, that's one of the reasons why, when I first saw the movie, why I was so into it. Cause when I was little, my dad would always play Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry. And cause my dad's almost 70. And I used to think the only musicians that existed were Elton John, the Beach Boys, and Chuck Berry. I didn't know there was such thing as anything else, except my brother was playing those 80s hair bands. And so I just grew up thinking that it was normal to know Beach Boys songs and Elton John, and not knowing when you're 7 years old, you're not supposed to be thinking about Chuck Berry. Well, I mean, you know what I mean? But that's great. Thank you for that story. Cause that was something that I loved when I had seen it. Was it not, didn't feel like two different movies, but it did have that documentary feel. I try so hard to break my bias to John Cusack because I am an 80s kid. So it's all about Say Anything and Paul Dano after There Will Be Blood. I'm just wondering if the guy will ever do wrong in a movie. And then, of course, as you know, now he's, you know, he's directing that great movie Wildlife. Yep. I think it was Wildlife with Jake Gyllenhaal. And and then how great is he as just a silent kid in Little Miss Sunshine? I mean, he doesn't even talk to the last 20 minutes of the movie, and like you buy it. So what I'll do is move into the last few questions here, if that's cool with you, how we how we wrap things up with any guests. We are homaging Inside the Actor's Studio, but don't worry, I'm not going to ask you what your favorite sound is. Let's see. Okay, first one is scripts there, budgets there, stories there. Whoever you want to work with is there, but I reversed the question. Let me mix that up. I mixed it up. What is a genre that you have to do before, let's just say someone was saying you have to hang up your camera, but you get to do this genre, kind of like your dream genre?
Film noir.
Film noir. Interesting. You think like like more like a Double Indemnity, just like that, those years as a whole in the 40s?
I you know, since the quarantine, I've been watching a lot of TCM. And a couple movies that stood out that I never saw before. One was called Out of the Past, and Pick Up on South Street was the other one. And I just love those movies, and I just love everything about them. And you know, it's as a cinematographer, you get the opportunity to do all kinds of fun things that you wouldn't ordinarily get to do on a film. And I really do love film noir. I mean, it's probably my favorite. And I'm trying to think back if I've ever shot a movie film noir. I don't think I have, but that would be, if you said, what kind of movie would you really want to do? I would say film noir.
So you'd want to work with Howard Hawks or Billy Wilder. That's cool.
Sunset Boulevard, Double Indemnity, Sam Fuller with Pick Up on South Street. The Maltese Falcon. I mean, John Huston.
Oh, yeah, John.
I watched recently Night of the Iguana, which I'd never seen before, which I just thought was fantastic. You know, that's not really film noir, I guess, but, just so many great movies. In some ways, I think John Huston was underrated, if anything, as a filmmaker.
Oh yeah, I totally used to have arguments about him in film school. Our teacher showed us Treasure of Sierra Madre, and we were outside, everybody was just tearing it apart. My friend is from Mexico City, and just in that thick accent, he just walked up and he said, when you can direct your father to an Oscar and your daughter to an Oscar and win an Oscar, you can talk bad. If not, shut the fuck up. And then like walked away. And I was like, that's a great way of putting it, to not knock John Huston. Like, I was
Yeah.
Don't have to own the, right? You don't have to buy Treasure of Sierra Madre, but you can't remotely act like it didn't influence There Will Be Blood with so many years later. But
yeah.
Okay. Thank you for those TCM mentions, by the way, because that I used to just so junk out on TCM. And then when it started to be that you had to have a cable box, I became I have like seven different streaming services for the show. So I'm just like always going wild with like whenever I have Criterion, I get nothing done. So that's why I kind of have to stay away from some of those films. So the other question is a genre that, you know, maybe you remember those film days where you weren't making rent, you haven't eaten in a few weeks, the lights are off, but there's no way you're going to take this job and shoot this film. Is there a genre you would not do?
Well, let me think about that. You know, I try to avoid, and I've done a lot of comedies, you know, but I try to avoid the really stupid comedies, you know, and I just, you know, and when I started doing it, I work with Paul quite a bit, Paul Feig, and we had done Bridesmaids and Spy, and, you know, and I was getting every dumb comedy script in America where people were, the punchline is somebody throws up over somebody else, you know, or, you know, and I just, you know, and I'm not saying I wouldn't do a movie where someone throws up, but it's just, do we really have to go there? And you know, I find that movies really, maybe less today than when I grew up, because the kids are all on the internet so much now. But, you know, they really influence people. And you know, particularly when I grew up, they were a huge influence on people. And it's like, let's try to elevate ourselves as humans rather than degrade ourselves as humans. So, you know, if I read a script that I find it's just a lot of gross humor and a lot of people throwing up on each other, you know, I just like, you know what? I have no interest in this. I don't find it funny. I don't think it's cool. And, you know, I'm the wrong person, because when they're actually shooting them, everybody on the set's laughing, and the writers and director and everybody's sitting there thinking it's the funniest thing in the world. And I'm there thinking, this is just stupid, you know? And so I like to work on something that's a little more intelligent than that. So I hope I answered your question.
Oh, no, that's great. I mean, if you're working with John Hughes, you'd rather do The Breakfast Club than Weird Science. That makes sense.
Well, actually, in all honesty, I actually did like Weird Science.
I just meant in what you were saying. Yeah, Weird Science is great.
Yeah, I mean, I remember as a kid, I actually kind of liked that movie. But God, I'm sorry, but who's the actor that played? Who recently died? A great actor. Say it again. Who was in Weird Science? He played Chet, the guy with the crew cut, the Marine.
Bill Paxton.
Bill Paxton.
Yeah, is that Bill? He passed away. I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. Well,
that's a bummer.
I was fortunate. He passed away a couple of years ago, and I was in New York years ago. And he's close friends with a good friend of mine. And my friend was having dinner with Bill Paxton one night in New York, and he said, "You want to come along?" I said, "Sure, I'd love to meet him." And so we were having dinner, and Bill Paxton was the nicest guy, the sweetest, nicest guy. And we were talking about movies and going on and on. And I brought up Weird Science because I think he was great at Weird Science. You know, he kind of stole the show in a way, you know, and he kind of laughed about it. But yeah, anyway. That's just a fun story.
No, I was rewatching it last night because our co-host has been, we brought on a woman co-host, and she's been leading me through John Hughes films, saying, watch them from the woman's point of view. So I'm like, you ruined Some Kind of Wonderful. It was about Amanda Jones and Leah Thompson. It's not about his friend Watts. And now when I watched it, I'm like, oh, it is about Watts. So that's I'm on an 80s binge right now. So, I think that about, wraps it up, myself and the team. I always let everyone know who's going to be on. So of course they're all fans of your work, and, from our team, we just wanted to say thank you for your time today and for joining us and for your wonderful stories.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time, Robert, and you have a great day.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. And that was a wonderful conversation with Robert Yeoman. You know my motto, whether it's morning, afternoon, evening, or whatever other kind of crazy COVID time you've found, make sure to watch a good movie. Heck, watch something that we just discussed. Watch Love and Mercy, watch Thor Cowboy, find something. Take care, peace and aloha.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, real conversation and movie-induced inspiration.